the Free for All Roundtable.
Round two.
On the roundtable, Sabrina Nanji is here from Queen's Park Observer. Bob Reed, principal at BroadwayStrategy.com, also the guy behind the very popular segment called Touchdowns and Fumbles. Chloe Brown, policy analyst, former candidate for mayor of Toronto, who we're still actually kind of tracking down because there seems to have been a connecting issue. So that's okay. We'll start with the people we got, and let's start with the budget. Bob Reed, my practice this morning has been to let people take it in any direction that they want. So your major takeaway from the federal budget?
I thought it was an interesting gambit that they are overtly targeting millennials, Gen X, the younger demographic. I think that's probably politically smart because the older demographics tend to not vote liberal. And they're also looking to try and create some daylight between them and the NDP going into the next election. Is this budget going to have big, long legs that will get them that far? Probably not. I don't think there are a lot of things in here that most people or younger people will be focusing on other than housing and affordability. And there are some goodies in there to help with that. I think for the rest of us, the bigger focus is going to be on $40 more billion in deficit spending. And the tax the rich move on the on the capital gains increase.
Yeah, a lot of people are definitely, you know, raising an eyebrow over that. Sabrina Nanji, your take.
Yeah, I think Bob kind of hit the nail on the head talking about, you know, the goodies for, I guess, younger voters, millennial voters, because if you think back to 2015, I mean, that sort of helped the Liberals come to power, right? Like, remember legalizing marijuana, that was something that was really popular with younger folks and got them out to the polls. But I think he's right. You know, it's maybe not everything we were expecting to see. They did sort of scoop themselves in the 2 weeks leading up to the budget, especially on some of those housing announcements that I know are landing probably as the Liberals would have wanted. They've gotten some good news headlines on that. But I think maybe one thing that stood out to me on the capital gains in particular was that while this is getting a lot of backlash, and, you know, in my view, it's kind of hard to sympathize for this point, like, or 0.13% of people, I think that this has kind of been a bit of a trap for the Conservatives, because if you heard Pierre Poilievre, he didn't quite say, you know, he's going to roll that back. He's having trouble answering that, you know, what would you do if you were in power? And so while I think that, you know, this budget sort of leaves us wanting more, I have a feeling that the Trudeau Liberals are probably saving the rest of the goodies for closer to the election. So this definitely feels like the precursor to the pre-budget election that everyone's going to be looking out for.
I'm inclined to agree that, yeah, there'll be one final budget. And Chloe Brown, it's worth noting, I don't know that anybody's ever changed the conversation with a budget. So I'm not sure if this is changing the conversation for the Liberals.
I would definitely say it isn't. As a millennial myself, I didn't feel like anything was there for me. I saw some funding going to student work placements, but that's really targeted to people in college and university. I saw some funding for housing, but that doesn't speak to a lot of the young contractors and skilled tradespeople that want to start their own businesses and they need land. There needs to be more clarity about what is for what demographic. And as I was looking through the budget, there were some good things, like they were talking about lowering bank fees. They're talking about providing funding for co-ops. And I would have liked to see more funding for cooperatives, because millennials and Gen Z are asking for greater ownership of these decisions, the infrastructure, and the programs that are being put forward.
So Toronto's Catholic School Board has decided to build a school inside a condo building. Let me come back to you, Chloe. I like this kind of inventiveness, and a lot of people probably don't know that in New York City, for example, you'll find an elementary school in the fourth story of a skyscraper. It's not out of the ordinary.
I think it's a great idea. It was something I talked about during the elections, that we really need to start looking at the air rights above ground floor buildings. And the schools are a really great place to start, especially as we think about the teacher shortage, the need for more education assistance for students with disabilities. And ultimately, this would be a really great way to address our Catholic School Board and TDSB issue of having too many schools, not enough students.
Yeah, Bob Reed, it also may be a fairly inventive solution for things like building a school cheaper and also having a school that matches like LEED environmental standards and stuff like that.
Absolutely. This is really smart development, and it's proven successful. Near my home is the new North Toronto Collegiate, which was incorporated into the ground floor of a new condo development. The developer took what was the site of a 120-plus-year-old woefully out of date, historical, but long past its prime, high school, leveled it, built a brand new condo development, put a brand new state of the art school in it at ground level, and a brand new football field. It's a win-win all the way around. So bring this stuff on, I say.
Yeah, Sabrina, for some people, I guess it may be counterintuitive thinking of a school being integrated with other kinds of properties, but it just makes sense.
Yeah, I'm with my co-panelists here. I think this is a great idea. I love the concept of like having a complete neighborhood inside a condo. You know, like the condos in a big city like Toronto are obviously the new neighborhoods. We need parks, grocery stores, schools, you name it. I think this is a great idea. And maybe we can take it one step further. I mean, there's all this talk about how we have empty office buildings downtown. Why not throw some schools in there?
British MPs are voting to make tobacco illegal for future generations. It's kind of an interesting model. And Sabrina, I'll start with you on this one. The idea is that every year you'll tack on an extra year where people are prohibited from starting to smoke until you get to the point where everyone is too old to smoke.
Yeah, in theory, I can kind of understand it, but I feel like this might, give a boost in a way to the black market, right? I mean, obviously, we've seen when something gets legalized or even criminalized, you know, the opposite happens. That I do wonder if this is going to end up, you know, giving the black market a boost too. And I don't really know if any future governments could simply just pass a law reversing this. So I know that there's a lot of hurdles this proposal still needs to get through. It seems like it's likely going to become law, but I just think that some of the unintended consequences could potentially be dire, even though obviously I like the idea of young people not being sold cigarettes.
Sure. Well, Chloe Brown, it may be overkill because I don't know about England, but in Canada, I think the smoking rate is down to like 11%.
I think it's a bit of overkill, especially for tobacco. I know our Indigenous communities integrate tobacco into some of their practices. So I'm kind of wondering if this was to be brought over, how it would be enforced. And then secondly, nicotine is the addictive substance. So I question why you're going after tobacco when nicotine is the real issue.
Interesting point. And Bob Reed, it brings me to another observation I had on this, which is I don't think smoking is the problem anymore. It's vaping.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly part of it. And I would hope that would be part of this legislative attempt to essentially phase it. It's like phased in prohibition, right? You know, they're setting an age limit, and then eventually, as you said, John, it will be completely eliminated. I'm someone who's always leery of imposing on people's liberties and freedom of choice to make even bad decisions. But at the same time, I kind of like this. I mean, we don't give people the right to not drive around without a seatbelt on because it's bad for you if you don't put the seatbelt on. There's nothing good about smoking. There's no benefit from it. And, I see friends of mine who have struggled to quit smoking because they've been smoking for decades, and never has one of them said, you know what, I'm really glad I started smoking way back when. So this is a bold move. I'm going to watch it with great interest because I think it might be a model for the future.
What do we make of the women's version of the official U.S. Olympic track kit? Chloe Brown, I was looking at images this morning and I thought, I don't know any women who would want to wear something like that, except maybe on a risque beach.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I saw the kit and it really dawned on me it might have not been created by a woman. So it's one of those things where with the Olympics coming up, it's like I would like to see more adaptable clothing for women, especially because when I saw the men's tracksuit, they had shorts that covered their legs and their genitals. That tracksuit for the women, I don't know if it will do the same thing.
Yeah, Bob Reed, I mean, without getting too graphic in things, I mean, I think a woman would have to shave in order to wear that outfit.
I think the comment that says it all was a post from U.S. long jump Olympian Tara Davis Woodall, who said, quote, "Wait, my hoo-ha's going to be out." That pretty much says it all.
I'm guessing this goes into the fumbles category for Friday.
They should have consulted with the athletes that they're going to make wear this stuff. And clearly they didn't, based on the backlash.
Yeah, Sabrina, I agree with Chloe. This could not possibly have been designed by a woman.
Of course not. And, you know, I'm surprised that this keeps happening. I mean, this isn't the first time. We had, I think it was like the Norwegian volleyball team a few years back sort of boycott the beach volleyball uniforms because they were too risque. And I think one of the athletes is saying now, you know, if this was going to make their performance better, that's what the men's uniform would look like, and clearly it's not. So this is just incredibly disappointing. I'm encouraged that there's at least a choice, but at the end of the day, like, even having those options, it's just so insulting. And, you know, we've already got to struggle with women's sports, especially compared to men's sports, and really I don't think something like a high cut bikini is going to make people tune in more. We should be focusing on the sport itself.
We've had this strange puzzling question over the last few weeks as to why there's a 1999 Toronto phone book in master control. Then I come across a story this morning that says why phone books are becoming obsolete. Bob Reed, I didn't even know they still made them.
You and me both. They used to land on my porch, and I haven't seen one in ages. And I don't think it needs a news site post to explain to us why phone books are becoming obsolete, because nobody uses them. We don't need them anymore. We have other tools to find phone numbers and contact information. I mean, what's next? Why encyclopedias are becoming obsolete?
Sabrina Nanji, I haven't used a phone book in forever. As a matter of fact, I was pointing out when I lost my cell phone recently, I don't even know what my friends' phone numbers are.
Yeah, of course, you just kind of have them saved as a name in your cell phone, right? I will say I do have a phone book, and I do sometimes look for, you know, politicians or old sources who may still have a landline. I'm not always successful, but I did find this one Instagram account that shows you how to grow mushrooms from old phone books, and I think that's probably the better use for them nowadays.
Chloe Brown, do you have any use for a phone book?
I actually have my own personal phone book for remembering birthdays, cell phone numbers, because I had a situation where a friend had a mental disturbance and his phone was off and we couldn't find his parents' number. And that was a wake-up call for me that not everyone has a cell phone. And when you lose a cell phone number, you should still find a family number. So while I don't agree with the mass publishing of phone books, everyone should have a personal phone book just in case you don't have access to electronics.
Thanks a lot for this. Good to talk with you all this morning. Sabrina Nanji, Chloe Brown, and Bob Reed.
Catch the Roundtable, round one at 7:45, round two at 8:45. Weekday mornings on More in the Morning. News Talk 1010, Toronto.